Welcome to Photography Insights. I'm your host, Andrew Walmsley. This is the show that interviews people from the photography world. Today's title is Climate, Prius and the End of the World, Michael Snyder. Today I'm shaking things up and will be a sign of the near future for the show. I watched a few documentaries recently and this got me thinking about a different type of photography. So today I'm interviewing someone who's not only a talented photographer, but a filmmaker too. Michael's worked for many years in the documentary and science field of photography. He's an educated man with a master's and bachelor degrees in science and a member of the Blue Earth Alliance. His work can be found in National Geographic, The Guardian, Washington Post and many other places. He's lived all over as well, Scotland, Japan, Hawaii, New Zealand, Washington, and now resides in Virginia in USA. We'll talk about some of his fun projects like The Visitor, Breathing Life, Demolition Men, The Roof Runner, and The Family at the End of the World. But we also find time to talk about climate science and his documentary Into the Dark 2. Michael's a father, adventurer, has a great character, and we have a laugh with my questions. So in this one, we discuss Trans-Siberian trains, how to make a story, local media, trying ideas, short and long-term projects, double exposure, being a spaceman, cultures, jumping Prius cars, climate change, and surfing in the Olympics. So I hope you enjoy this one. There'll be links to his website and his Instagram, and I'll put a couple of pictures up there. He's given me permission to take some off his website, so please do look out for them. His photography is, you know, absolutely outstanding, and there's some great stories from his travels as well, so I hope you check this one out. Please don't forget the friends of the show, Stuart Kramer, who creates these modular camera systems for medium format and large format. And obviously, the developing needs, check out Film Dev, who has some very good prices, and great and affordable zines from Static Age. And please don't forget to check out my Ko-fi donation page. All donations mean a lot, and you can help fund the show. Every little pound helps. For anyone checking out my Instagram, please do have a look. There's been some fun adventures in the dark room again, and please do watch out for a new website I've put together, and that is going to be purely showing my photographs. So it's purely a gallery type thing, like most of the artists I've interviewed, to show the finest work. It's only got a couple of projects and a brand new project I'm working on, which is all about me. So there we go. Selfish, I know. So yeah, let's play the music and await our guest Michael. And welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us all the way from America today.
Yeah, of course. Well, we're not that far apart with this technology, are we? It feels like we're almost in the same room.
Well, exactly, yeah. And but, you know, for a man who's so well-traveled, shall we say, you could have been from anywhere, really, couldn't you?
I have been lucky enough to spend some time in a few different places. But Britain is a second home for me in a big way. I lived there for a number of years. My wife's from there. I've got two kids that have all the rights to call that their home. So, yeah, it's nice to connect and get back to my second home audience. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, it feels like the other way around for me now. So many of my guests says, Andy, when are you coming over to America? Because, I mean, I must have interviewed 100 Americans. It must be by now.
Huh. Oh, cool. That's really cool. Well, that's great. Well, you know, there are talented people the world over. The more I look, around, the more I'm just blown away by the quality of work that's out there. But certainly in this country, there are a lot of people doing really exciting work, and I've got a lot of really great colleagues that I feel lucky that I've been able to connect with over the last few years. So I should dig through some of your content. I'm sure I'd recognize some names that you've got in there.
Yeah, definitely. Because obviously you said, Street Photography Magazine. And I was like, hang on a second. Because I remember, because I've listened to practically every podcast by Bob as well, you say. Yeah. So Bob was quite an early guest on my show. He helped give me some advice when I first set up, because he's such a lovely guy.
Yeah, Bob's great. He's really wonderful, and I'm lucky. I'm actually he's right here in the same town that I'm in. I'm in
Charlottesville,
Little Charlottesville, Virginia. You know, it's a town of about 50,000 people in central Virginia. And Bob is actually just down the road. So, him and I have got a chance to meet up quite a few times, and get a chance to chat. And what he's doing with his magazine is excellent. And he invited me as well to speak a few years ago. So they published a few pieces of mine, and I've actually passed some students onto them too. He's wonderful, and their work is really great to follow.
Yeah, it's nice to have that common interest. And again, it's another case of, you know, we wouldn't have known each other a couple of weeks ago, and yet here we are knowing such a great mutual person in common.
Yeah, well, that's the way the world works, man. It's a it really is the connections that grease all these things and make it happen. So it's really nice to meet you, and I'm glad that we've got that shared connection.
No, definitely. And it was interesting to see your history, because obviously you've done a lot of different things, let's face it. I mean, you know, hiking trails, riding in Europe, been in the trains in Asia. What is it? Challenges, fitness, culture? What motivates you for this?
Yeah, well, that's a good thing to highlight. You know, I feel very lucky that I grew up in the woods in Appalachia on the east coast of the States, and I at a very, very young age fell in love with being outdoors. And so a lot of what motivated me originally was getting into wild spaces. And so a lot of that travel was about seeing places around the world. I fell in love with teaching. I ended up doing a lot of either wilderness teaching or teaching traditional subjects, but in an outdoor space. And it was only sort of through doing that that I found a love for environmental science, which is what I studied both at the undergraduate and the graduate level, and also started taking photos. And it sort of followed on for that. But I'll also say that I had a connection to photography growing up, because my dad had worked in the 60s and 70s as a photographer. And then, of course, when I was born, that was no longer economically viable, and he moved on to other things. But I had learned from him, and he's a great influence in my work. So I had some earnest connection there. But, you know, it really wasn't for me. Making the transition to doing this full time wasn't something that I ever knew I was going to do. It's something that I thought more and more of doing when I was doing environmental work, because I started to see that, you know, we have so much of the science and the policy and the technology that we need to create transitions towards a more sustainable world. And the truth is we don't do a very good job about communicating narratives about what it means to live well on this planet without destroying it. And so it was really that realization that kind of kicked me into gear to make this less of a hobby and more of a full-time thing. And so I was shooting and you know, while I was doing all that travel, but the full-time work kicked in about a bit more than a decade ago.
Right, okay. So when did you pick up photography then? Was that through the traveling, or did you do that younger as well?
No, younger. So I got a camera from my dad, film camera. Probably the early 90s would have been the first true camera that I had. I shot with him a lot in the 80s as well. But my first true film camera was in the 90s. And then I had a grandfather pass away in 1997. And that was my first. It was my, you know, I had this gorgeous Nikon camera. I had no idea what I had. I didn't know that it was as nice as what it was. I'm actually going back and scanning all those old 35 millimeter negatives now, which are just just lovely to go through. I mean, they're just so rich. So I did get a start then, and I started shooting weddings at that time. I shot my first wedding about 20 years ago now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't, it was just sort of a hobby thing. And it wasn't until mm-hmm. I bought my first Canon camera when I took a trip on the Trans-Siberian Railroad in 2006. And that was the first time that I started moving into digital, and that was really the first documentary project that I worked on as well. So it wasn't until then that it became serious. But yeah, I've been in this world in some way or another since I was a kid.
Okay, that's interesting. Did you do the Trans-Siberian photography then? Was that a paid thing, or was you just something you really enjoyed doing, sort of thing?
No, I've always been independent. I mean, even now, you know, I usually, the way it works, you've got to go out in the field, start working on a story, develop a story, shoot a story, and only then can you go back to an outlet and pitch it. Now, sometimes these days I do get put on assignment, and they'll come to you with a story, and you'll shoot. But for me, oftentimes I'm developing the story with people that I know, and that means shooting it a bit before you ever get paid. But for that project, no. I had been living in Japan for a year and was heading back to the U.S. and decided to take the long way around. So I took trains from Japan back to Portugal is where I eventually came home from. And just shot it for fun. But it wasn't until years later that I was looking at that content and realized that I had a story that I could publish. And so that story ended up coming out in Condé Nast Traveler in 2016, I believe, and a few of the places as well. So it wasn't until much further down the road that I was able to publish that.
I see, yeah. No, that makes sense. Well, I suppose, like you say, it can take a while to realize what's in front of you, probably. And I suppose that's quite a big thing, surely, as like an independent person.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I'm actually talking to my dad about that just now. When I'm going back through, I'm helping him convert all of his old 35 millimeter negatives. And it's sometimes only years later when you go back and you look at your content, you can step back from it and find the threads you can pull through to make the connections and find a coherent photo essay. Sometimes that happens a long time after you've created the images. You know, and that's the way it can work as well. You've got to step back to be able to see the story. So yeah, I've had that experience, and I've had plenty of folks that I know in this field that have projects they shoot years and years before, and it never really made sense. Then one day it clicks, and they might publish it. It could be 10 years later from when they shot it.
And that's a hell of an achievement, though, because obviously it's a very big magazine. I mean, obviously you've been in National Geographic. I mean, you've been all over, haven't you, really?
Yeah, I feel very lucky for that. I've got to work with a lot of big names in publishing, and yeah, I think it's a great thing because you get to reach so many people, and that mm-hmm. that's a really big deal. You know, the stories that I work on are stories often that I deeply care about. They've got either an environmental angle on them, or they've got a social issue angle, and so reaching as many people as possible is a goal. But also, of course, when you walk in those spaces, it's a calling card that you can bring to other places too, practically, you know, and so it helps you get more work done. But, you know, I feel very strongly about this. In addition to publishing in some of these bigger outlets, I still do as often as I can try to work with local media and in the spaces that I create the work, try to go back to those places and show the work there as well. So I've got a lot of local partners. Sometimes that can be a publishing partner, but it could also be a local gallery or an outlet or a community center. And just to give you an example, I just published a piece 2 weeks ago in a magazine called The Bitter Southerner, and it was retweeted by the New York Times food blog actually a week later, and so it got seen by tons of people, and that's great. But this is in Appalachia where I'm from, and it was really important to me to bring the printed work back and show it in a gallery there. And now I'm working on installing those photos in the streets there as well. So for me, it's sort of straddling that global reach while also making sure you're reaching, you know, home communities and frontline communities. And if you're working on environmental issues, impacted communities, so that they're also getting the content as well and feel connected to it.
Wow, now that's really nice. Yeah, I really like that sentiment. That's fantastic. Obviously, some of the things that I focused on your website and looking at your work was the array of different things you've done. So what I want to start first with was something that stood out to me was this Roof Runner series. Now, I mean, this was looks so different. I don't think I've ever seen anyone do photography about this. Obviously, we've all seen these free runners, but tell me about it. It looks great.
Yeah, thanks. So this project, it really just came out of this memory that I had one day where I was remembering that as a kid, when we go on road trips, and I'd go on these long road trips with my mom over the summer, and I would be sitting in the back of the car. I think like a lot of people do. I think probably a lot of people have a different version of this, and looking idly out of the back of the car. This is before, any kind of digital entertainment was available to kids, and so you'd look out of the window and you just imagine. And so for me, it was imagining me being able to run really quickly alongside of the car wherever we were going. So, if we were, out in the wild space, I might be jumping on trees or swinging from vines or hopping over rivers. And if we were in urban spaces, I'd be jumping from building to building. So I just remembered this one day and thought, well, that would be a fun project to be able to kind of recreate what that looks like in my mind. So I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and just went around and took photos of all these different kind of urban spaces. And then I went back behind the studio that I had, and I photographed myself jumping over and over and over again. I'm sure I weirded out anybody was walking by because I was jumping for like an hour trying to get all these different kind of jump poses with my timer. And then photoshopped myself into these scenes. And part of the challenge there was just getting the lighting right to make sure that I didn't, I wanted to look real enough. And so I really had to try to shoot these buildings and shoot myself under the same lighting conditions, which was it could be a little tricky to do. But anyway, I made it just for fun. It was really to entertain myself, and I put it out on Beautiful Decay, which is a small periodical here in the U.S. And this is a good example of what we're talking about. The next day, I got a call from somebody at The Guardian that said, "Hey, we saw your work. We want it immediately. We want it for our magazine." And it got published in The Guardian, and it went all over, And so, and that was one of
Wow.
my first big publications, So, and it still gets some traction. I still get people. It's been, I don't know how many years ago now, 8 years maybe, but I still get people that write me about it.
That's great. Just imagine that all from a like a childhood sort of event. It's great. It's I love the analogy of like your idle imagination causing this. Cause to me, that's what you artists are. You come up with this idea. It's not like anything is pre-planned. No one's give you a script. It's just come. You've just done it.
Yeah, and this, to be honest, it was shot in, a few days, right? It's some, and the, you know, that's the funny thing about doing this work, at least for my own process, is that you have hundreds and hundreds of ideas. Maybe you try 20 of them, and 19 are kind of non-starters. You don't get them anywhere. They sort of get them going, and they just fall apart. But you might have one that just shows up, and you get it done in a few days, and then it just goes everywhere and it takes off. And so, maybe for other people, they sort of plod along, and things move at kind of regular intervals. But in my working life, it's sort of a lot of thinking time and waiting time, and then quick bursts where it takes off. But it can be hard to predict what takes off and what doesn't,
Well, I've interviewed people across the broad spectrum in that sense. One lady I interviewed, a project which lasted 10 years. So, you can imagine the scale of this stuff is sometimes crazy. You speak to other people and they might be out with a husband and they notice something and the next day she had a project idea. And you're like, wow.
Well, and I'll say that I recognize that process as well, and maybe we'll come to some of those projects down the road in this conversation. But I also have a few projects that are 10 year. I have one that's in 10 years now. I have another one that's in about 8 years, and it's just a very different approach to storytelling. But I also have that kind of working life as well. But even with those, you still spend most of the time is spent for me behind the scenes, building relationships, building trust, getting to know the community that you're working in. These are more documentary projects. And then, you know, even over 10 years, the number of days in the field for me might only be, I don't know, 30, 40. I haven't kept track. But so it still kind of happens in bursts, even if it happens over a long period of time.
I see. I mean, I really love that. So that's really cool. But then, you know, you look at something else, like you're breathing life. So for our listeners who obviously can't see what I'm looking at, these are what we call artistic double exposures. So some of our listeners are familiar with some double exposures from other people where there's, say, part of a person and they've exposed trees, fruits, and this sort of thing over the top. Now, yours are a little bit different, I would say. In a nice way.
Yeah, thanks. This is a project from back in 2014. And, you know, I just got really captured by the idea of the relationship that animals, in particular humans, have with the plant world, in that we both respirate, right? Breathing is something that's central to what we do, but also central to what plant life does. And my wife is a yoga instructor, and I had a friend at the studio that I was working in. His name is Hawa, and he's also in this project. He was a yoga instructor, and sort of the three of us got thinking about how do we show this like deep symbiotic relationship, this commonality that we have between all life, but again, in particular for this project, plant life and human life. So the way that I came up to do that was to superimpose there's a collection of images of my wife and a collection of images of Hawa in yoga poses with plant life that are you know, double exposed. So you'll have to go and look at the images to make sense of it, but you kind of see parts of their body are missing and they're sort of taken over by plants. But you know, for me as a photographer, in addition to, you know, hopefully it's a good looking outcome, but the challenge of it was that these were all, they're not done with Photoshop, actually. They're all done in camera. And I read about this option that Canon cameras have. I think most cameras have this nowadays, but where you can go and take one photo and then you turn, you know, and left or turn right or up or down and take a second photo, and right there in the camera, it will double expose the way that you would have done it with film. You know, you're just taking two photos on top of each other. And so that also interests me, that sort of technical challenge of having to make these work in the field, you know, so sort of looking at these poses and thinking about, okay, what plants do I see around me that I can, you know, overlay onto this that'll look nice.
Yeah, it works really well. But again, it's not just pictures. You know, you've got this meaning because obviously, you know, you talk a lot and care about the environment, don't you? So you've added that element in, which is really good.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea, right? Is that, you know, to take care of ourselves, ultimately, we need to take care of the environment. And I think properly, you know, understood, our well-being and environmental well-being is deeply interlinked. And so it's part of this is making that sort of invisible truth, which is all around us, but is also can be quite invisible to us, visible in some sort of creative way, hopefully. So yeah, that's kind of the impetus behind it, and I hope people pick that up from it. In addition to hopefully that they're nice looking images, there is kind of a deeper thing that I wanted to get after with it.
Yeah, and you say this was done with like a community. Is it Washington Park?
Yeah, so at the time I was living in Washington, D.C., and I had a studio in a building called Washington Parks and People. The building is called the Josephine Butler Park Center, and it's run by an organization called Washington Parks and People. And it's a nonprofit hub in Washington, D.C., and one of the oldest in the city. And so I ran my studio out of there, but there were 13 other nonprofits that are at that organization as well. And just a lovely place to be in the city. The park that these were shot in is the building that I was in overlooks that park. It's called Meridian Hill Park. So it's just a really beautiful spot in the city.
Sounds lovely.
No, it was a good time.
Why did you move?
We had a kid. urban living was not going to be accessible to me as a photographer with a child. So we moved to the countryside.
No, I understand. I mean, I saw the visitor project you've worked on, and all, and I like this concept. So for the listeners, this feels like... could be like a thing out of a science fiction film where someone's wearing like an astronaut's outfit and they're obviously coming to like Earth for the first time, but it's all around like abandoned areas, isn't it?
Yeah, so this project, it's really born out of my studies in environmental science. And, you know, sometimes that feel can be quite apocalyptic. I mean, it really depends on who you listen to, but, you know, the news there can be pretty dire, and certainly you're working with troubling issues. And also, just for the last 20 years, I feel like a lot of the media, whether it's zombie stories or disaster stories or you know, pandemic stories, and now, of course, we've had one, you know, I think people have, there's been some anxiety about what the future looks like. Not that that's a new thing. I mean, certainly the 20th century was filled with anxiety about what the future was going to be too. But anyway, that was some of the impetus for creating this project, was sort of thinking about what would it be like for a spaceman to come to this planet after humans are gone. You know, we don't know why they're gone. We just know they're not around anymore in this story. And this individual is exploring this space for the first time. And, you know, we don't get into, you know, saying, is it a human that's come back or is it an alien or whatever? You just know that there's this person exploring spaces. And but what was really fun about making this project is I shot it with two good friends of mine, and we went out and just really tried to each of us get into that character. We took turns being the spaceman, and this is shot in Richmond, Virginia, and we just went around to some of these abandoned spaces that are there and just kind of, you know, really tried to feel out what it would be like, and we took turns shooting it. So again, sort of a fun project. We've talked about going back and kind of wrapping it up and publishing it, but actually this project has never been published, so it's just sitting on my website for anyone to go and enjoy. But it's we've never fully wrapped it up.
That's interesting, because it's a good thought, because it's so true that any sort of film you look at is pretty much disaster orientated about the future. There are so few that paint a rosy picture for the future for us, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. You know, it would be really fun, I think, to do a project that moves in that direction. I mean, this one is very much in keeping with kind of a bleak look on what the future would look like. But maybe, you know, that's a fascinating idea. Like, what would it look like to create a very future-oriented story where, you know, I think it'd be quite boring if it was just a glowing utopia. I don't think that would be interesting. But is there a way to create a future narrative that isn't apocalyptic? You know, it's a counterpoint to that. So I think that's a wonderful starting place for a project idea.
There we go. So, audience, Michael's that's project. That's your next decade sorted, mate. All right. On top of everything else.
Yeah, obviously. I'll put that in somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a small thing, you can fit that in, no problem. it's so true. I think some people talk about the idea of future that science is going to save us. I think they're the few people that are clinging on to that. There's also the people who believe in science and, you know, listen to the scientists. Things have to change. We have to make things now before we're too late. So it's like, it's a tough one. Do you think we'll come up with amazing energy sources that will save us and will cure climate?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I'll say a few things. I think first, history is the study of surprises. So it's really hard for people at any given time to know what the story that they're enmeshed in is and where it's going. And so I think it's very, very difficult to say where we're going to be. That said, I think a lot of the things that people do point towards is serious, serious concerns we need to, you know, take seriously and act on, things like climate change. They are a big deal. I mean, I think the science on that is quite clear. The questions on what we do about it are much stickier. And I oftentimes advocate for drawing a much bigger circle around the people at that table getting to make that decision. I think we need a lot of different tools. I think I was just saying this earlier today in another interview that I was in, that I think good change, good social movements are diverse change and diverse movements. And I just think that there's a lot of ways to get after that. So do I think that there will be technological solutions? Absolutely. I think big tech has got a role to play in this. Do I think there'll be political solutions? Absolutely. Will there be local grassroots solutions to just protesting make a difference? I think it does. Are there pathways on this earth that people are already living in ways that are sustainable that we can look towards? And I think the answer is yes. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to get this done. Will we get this done? You know, the track record of humans is we seem to have to stumble and fall a lot, don't we, to be able to yeah. to move forward. And so it's but for all of that, we have, you know. So I guess it's a choice to feel this way, but I do have quite a bit of hope for people. But that doesn't mean that we don't have some hard times to go through to figure that out. And it doesn't mean that we know what that's going to look like. But I tend to try to stay in a hopeful space as much as I possibly can with the work that I do. And I tend to really like to showcase people that have hope and people that have solutions that they're working on and people that keep an open mind about what that might look like and extend, you know, moral consideration and humanity to other people. I think we can have strong values and strong opinions, but I do believe we need to be civil, and I do believe we need to work really hard to see the humanity in other people, even people that don't agree with us. So I try to keep it, I try to hold on to truth where I see it, but I also try to keep it as civil as I can.
No, that's a good answer. Yeah, it's tough. You know, we're in an age of science at the minute, and we're in an age of technology, aren't we? So we have to listen to both, but at the same time, like you say, we have to listen to other sources. So whether it is the social aspects and social sciences, do we have to consider art as well and artists' thoughts and political views? That there is so much. I mean, even little things like we've started thinking about film photography, for instance. Mm. We know the chemicals are awful for the planet, for us. So at some point, it has to change. And it'll be awful, but we might have to do it. And I'm not saying digital's the answer, because crikey, the chemicals that go into a digital sensor, let's face it, are no better.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, no, it poses its own challenges. And it is difficult right now to see how we, granting all of the challenges that we have in front of us, whether, like you were saying, it's climate, or it could be about species extinction, it could be about toxins in the environment. There will be significant changes ahead of us if we're going to get to a more sustainable space. I think that at least we can bet on. But you're right, there's many different kinds of truths, and there's many different ways to work at truth and to work at change. You can work in an art space, and I think you can be doing good work there. You could work in a scientific space and be doing good work there. You could work in a community organizing space or a business space and be doing good work there. So I think it's a yes and conversation. And I think, again, we got to find a way to confront the powers and the hurdles that limit those changes and limit what's possible. While also, again, working to have mutual understanding and draw a big circle and pull people together and you know, protect the most vulnerable people that stand to lose the most in these kind of scenarios. So it's hard work, but, you know, I stay hopeful as often as I can.
Nice. Well, that's the second challenge for you then.
That's right.
That's 2 decades sorted for you.
It might take more than 2 decades for us to make that transition. Maybe it'll take all the rest I've got. We'll see how many that
well,
is.
Well, fair enough. No, I get you. Let me take you to some of your other work as well then. So, obviously, this one I really loved. It really stood out. Again, I've not seen many people take photographs of Demolition Men. Now, I think what I really liked here is this takes me back. So in the UK, we had things like this speedway with motorbikes going around a track, and obviously there is still this. I can't remember what we call over it. It's not Demolition Derby, but it's a similar thing to what you're showing. And is it this retro thing that we can't step away from?
Yeah, so I'll just say a little bit about this project. So this is called Demolition Men, and it's a project I've been working on for 5 years. I've been going to a county fair in southwestern Pennsylvania. That's on the east coast of the U.S. And southwestern Pennsylvania is not very far from where I grew up. So this is in Appalachia, and there's a demolition derby there. Now, it's not the only place with demolition derby. These things happen at county fairs all over. But it's a place that I happened to land on because I had known some folks that had gone there. And yeah, for me, like I just think demolition derby is just so fascinating because there's something so primal and kind of, it's almost like a coliseum kind of thing, right? It's really quite violent.
Please.
It's actually rather dangerous. It's interesting that people want to do it and want to watch it, and yet it's also very compelling. I mean, it's sort of high human drama, and so that was a reason I got interested. And another reason is it's just like this is, I think, such an odd thing. It maybe is not odd in the developed world that we would do this. It's definitely not odd in America. It's very common in America. But to the developing world, this idea that you would take like functional cars, I mean, a lot of times these things are, expensive, still useful pieces of technology, and for no other reason, smash them together. It's just kind of an oddity. I think, again, we take it for granted, but for other people around the world, this might be seen as something very, very strange. And then finally, this is a space that's changing. I mean, I think if you want to call this a tradition, and I think it is in the area that I'm doing this here, I don't think it's going anywhere for a while. But in talking to people that do this, really demolition derby works well when you have these old steel chassis cars that are heavy and you smash them together and they don't, disintegrate on one hit, right? You can sort of need these big steel chariots. And a lot of modern cars just don't do that, right? They've got plastic parts, and you smash them together, and they stop working. So in some ways, people in this region think maybe this is going away, because they have to go and try to find these old cars, which are hard to find now. And also, some of the folks that I've been documented say, my kids are not as into it anymore. Now we've got other things to entertain us. We don't, before you go out, the only thing you had in your backyard was an old car, and so you learned how to fix it up and smash it. And now, of course, in places like Appalachia, we have the internet. And that's a relatively new thing. So the third reason for documenting this, I think, is just because it's a place that's changing really, really quickly. And so if this may not be something that is done commonly in another 10 years. And so this is one of three projects that I have in Appalachia, and they're all looking at sort of changing spaces and identities and exploring that in a very long-term sense. And I don't know how long I'll keep doing this work, but like I said, I'm about 5 years in, and I might have another few more years to go.
It's true though, like you say, this is pure documenting the history of the USA.
Yeah, that's right.
Just like, yeah, I mean, over here, like for instance, like we've said, I'm from Lincolnshire. Over here, I can tell you the biggest thing a lot of locals do is game hunting. So they go out shooting pheasants and foxes and stuff like that. And I'm from 30 miles away, in a city, in a town, and I'd never heard of such rubbish when I was a child. Shooting was for people, not animals and things like that. So coming to live here, and that's 30 miles away. We had totally different culture.
That's it, right? Is that there's all of these little subcultures that exist that are just fascinating to look into, and they can be totally normative to the people that are in those cultures. Like you said, I mean, if you're in that space, you're like, oh, this is totally normal, it's just what we do. But if you're 13 miles away, you've never been to one of these things, it might as well be another world. And so, for me, one of the great joys of doing documentary photography is you just get to be a voyeur in spaces that are not your space, and you don't know them. You haven't maybe even earned really the right to be there, but by virtue of being invited in and trusted, and gaining that trust, you get to see this whole world that you had no idea existed. And that is definitely one of the real kicks of doing documentary work. It's just getting to navigate in these very, very different, very weird, very wild spaces. And Demolition Derby, I got to say, is one of them. Talk about a real, real cultural experience. it is even for me, and I grew up there, you know. But I can imagine, and I shoot behind the scenes when I go there. I get to stay in the sort of area where they're all working on the cars and everything, and it's a fantastic and just fascinating space with just fascinating people.
Yeah, you're definitely right. I think that was more the old-fashioned car because there was less automatic and electrical things. It was more manual engineering in essence, wasn't it? So it, you know, it's definitely a thing over here. They still do it. They tend to do it on lower price cars because, like you say, at the end of the day, you won't be going up crashing Toyota Priuses.
Yeah, that's right.
It'd just be useless.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Yeah, it doesn't have quite the doesn't have quite the same sound when you fire it up either. You know, these there's a lot of emphasis on making a lot of sound when you're coming to the track. So yeah, your Prius is not gonna cut it.
Maybe we've just invented a new sport.
That's the thing. You got to look towards what's next. maybe it's like Prius jumping. Yeah. You know, like those big, the big ski jumps they have, you know, in the Olympics. You take your Prius down there and you send it up in the air and you do a few flips. You know, so maybe there's some new thing that'll come.
We've just invented the new game for the Olympics, Michael. You're a genius.
Hey, man, that was your idea. Gotta have shared credit there.
No, that's cool. Yeah. What I need to do is probably talk. The last bit of photography or moving to your film work is Family at the End of the World. And I'd come across this picture, and it's an interesting picture. So for the listeners, it's a child on a trampoline, and in the background is nothing but mountains. It's literally like, you know, what are people doing living here?
Yeah, so this is probably my best known image to date. It's it won the Portrait of Humanity Award from the British Journal of Photography last year, and it just won or was shortlisted, I should say, for the Welcome Prize, which is also a UK based prize as well. And So I'll give a little bit of backstory about making this image, and then I'll say a little bit about what it is and why it works. But because I do a lot of climate change work, I was on an expedition a few years ago into the Arctic, but during the winter months, and we'll talk about that here in a minute because I made a film about that, and I know that's on our agenda to talk about. But anyway, when I was there filming, we were there during the time of year where the sun doesn't rise for 4 to 6 months, depending on where you are at polar latitudes, which was an amazing experience. And I'll tell you about that here in a sec. But I just got, in doing that project, I just got really fascinated by the Arctic in general for a lot of reasons. But one of them is that it's one of these places on the planet that's changing really, really quickly. I mean, we're all experiencing change due to climate change, but the Arctic is, an order of magnitude greater. And this, coming to this photo, I was there. This is on the island of Svalbard, which is an archipelago of islands north of Norway. And this is probably about 70-something degrees north latitude, so it's pretty far up there. And and I was there in summertime, and I was there on assignment with Orion Magazine, which is a magazine based here in the U.S., and also Terrain Magazine for two projects, looking at permafrost melt, because the town of Longyearbyen, which is the world's northernmost town, is also the world's fastest warming town. To get this exact figure right, people would need to go and look this up. But it is already, over the last 50 years, seen a rise of several degrees Celsius, and I believe even more rise over the winter months than the summer. So anyway, when I was there, I was on assignment shooting, but I had this one extra day, and I tried to think about ways to make the most out of the fact that I was, you know, at the end of the world shooting this project, and could I shoot anything else? And I had made this connection with somebody that I had met in Norway, and I said, do you know anybody in Svalbard? And he knew this family, and this is a family that has a house at the, like, just about at the very northernmost end. There's a road that goes out of Longyearbyen, so they're even, outside of there. So they're the northern end of the northernmost town, and they have this house there. And this photo, and you're looking at this, you're looking out, and there really is nothing beyond where this girl is standing. I mean, you're truly looking out into wilderness. There'll be a few things that are out that way, but I mean, this is a very, very wild space. And part of what works about this photo is you have a trampoline, which is what you would think in the developed world, just a very normal childhood thing in this incredibly wild, wild space. So I think, and then the colors just work. There's a lot of things that work about it photographically, but I think compositionally, I should say. But I think one of the reasons why it's been picked up is it's been a really great way to talk about a number of different environmental issues. We can talk about the rights of future generations. Mm-hmm. In this case, there's a child, and right behind her is this, you know, this landscape that's changing very quickly. It'll change very, very quickly in her time. The reason it was picked up by the Wellcome Prize is to talk about disease, actually, and how as permafrost melts, we have the possibility of unlocking diseases that may have been trapped into the ice for thousands of years. And so it's a way to talk about disease. And I think there's a lot of other things that you could layer onto this image. So it's been a really powerful image. I'd love to go back and shoot more around this project. But one of the things that's, I just think kind of interesting about this, and it goes back to what we were saying about these kind of bursts of work, is that, I was there at the home with these folks for maybe 2.5 hours. You know, it was, and I had about 1 second to capture this image. I probably shot a string of 10 in a row, and this is the one where she was in just the right spot. And so it also is just about being there and being there at the right place at the right time. And I knew when I was shooting the image, I knew that I had got something that was good. And that's a pretty rare feeling for me, but I remember feeling like, no, I got something here. Now this is going to work. And it's been exciting to see that play out.
Oh, you can see it's so special. Cause like you say, you do get this feeling of there is nothing more, but it could be another country where it's just looking onto the Alps or the Andes or something, but to be literally at the end of the world, I mean, they're brave people.
Well, see, that's the funny thing. I think so too. And to me, they're, it's a family of four of six. And, two parents and four kids, and they run a dog sledding business that's out there. And to me, this is, I mean, wild, right? There's so few people on this island. They really are so far removed from other people on the planet. And they live in, I mean, there are polar bears roaming around this place. And they come and they go around here. This is truly wild, wild spaces. And for me, that would take a lot of courage. That's living pretty bravely, especially with young children and, raising them, in that space. But to them, I think they're aware of that. But the impression I get from that family is it's normal to them. They wouldn't want to be anywhere else. This is home, and this is what it looks like. And it's just, it's day-to-day life, for them. And to me, that's fascinating. And so part of the story that I want to tell is just exploring what it's like to live, a normal human life, if you can call it that, in this space that is just not normal for all of the rest of us. This is not how the rest of us live. And again, that comes back to part of what I think works about this image is this sort of tension between a not normal space. I mean, most of us don't live in these very, very wild spaces, especially when you know what this is a photo of. And this girl also doing this like relatively normal thing that most of us recognize.
But it's also like you said earlier, that this is every day to them, but not to us. But also that they could be part of this idea of hunting and this primeral thing that we had to do before we had houses and jobs and security, and they are still in that sort of place, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's an interesting part of it too. There's kind of a rewilding thing here. There's something that's kind of primal. Mm-hmm. And they're for example, they're teaching their kids at a very young age how to do things like hunt and how to do things like forage and these sort of skills that we would have been very, very natural to us. But as of hundreds of years ago now, most of us, not all of us on the planet, but most of us have lost for better or for worse. And it's a mix of both, but But in any case, this is a family that's living much closer to an elemental life. And I think that's just really fascinating to a lot of us. There's something that's deep inside of all of us that wonders what it would be like. But, you know, on the other hand, they're also a very, very modern family. I mean, I wrote the mother an email earlier today. You know, it's not like they don't have the internet. It's not like they don't, you know, have, you know, access to modern things and don't enjoy that. They do as well. So it's just kind of a fascinating thing for me where they're sort of straddling both of these worlds. And I think there's a lot there to explore. So I hope now with some of the recognition for the photo, it's going to allow me to get the commission or the grant that I need to be able to go back there and to continue working on this project. Yeah.
No, that's cool. It's funny because I think I'd only read about the island in Wired magazine recently.
Yeah.
I think there'd been a science piece there. And I think, am I right in saying there is a big science colony there at the minute?
There is, yes. And there has been quite a bit of media in the last 5 or 6 years about Svalbard, in part because it's being recognized. It is changing so quickly. There is a university there, that's probably what you're talking about, called UNIS. And it's a big research station where people come from all over the world to conduct Arctic research, and it's also where the International Seed Bank is, where these seeds are kind of locked away and frozen into permafrost, and that's had some attention as well, because it looks now like there could be some threats to that permafrost melting, and so this plan to store the world's seeds is in jeopardy. I'm not sure what the final answer is to that. I want to say that perhaps they think now they can stabilize it and it's not as big of an issue, But anyway, for all of those reasons, there has been a lot of attention on Svalbard. And so, you know, I've been trying to think about ways to work in that space, but add something new. Hmm. And sort of this deeper character dive has seemed like an interesting way to talk about this place.
Yeah, I can understand that. Well, I think the humanity of living in places is like you said, because it's so different, often science needs a little bit of background to people, doesn't it? Because people are just not interested in pure science.
Yes. Yeah.
Don't work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't. Actually, just yesterday I was speaking at a climate change conference, and one of the things that I always say, I was speaking to quite a few scientists and researchers, is how many of you have read the IPCC report, which is basically the Bible of climate change, is where all of the, you know, the major research gets published and put together. It's about that thick. And I asked them to, by a show of hands, how many of you have read it? And the hands go up, and I say, liars, none of you have read this. Nobody reads this stuff. Like, you're the scientist, and I know you even don't read all this scientific data, because it's just not engaging. It's just not entertaining, right? And so we know a few things. One is that, you know, if we're going to create media, we're competing for people's attention. And if it isn't interesting and engaging and fascinating, and it has characters that are relatable, and it isn't beautiful, or doesn't have any sort of emotive content, people tend to tune it out, because you've got Netflix right there and you can watch something else. So that's one thing. And the second is that we know that most people, we like to think of ourselves as very rational animals, and we make the decisions that we make based on the best possible science and data information. But the truth is, most studies tell us that we're actually very emotive animals, and we make decisions based on emotional responses and on social norms, right? And so I think and this is one of the reasons why I was giving this talk, is I think people in the science spaces, and I do think that science is getting much savvier about this, understanding that you've got, if you want to talk about these issues, you need to engage with visual storytellers as well. You need to engage with people that are in the private sector. You need to engage with, nonprofit organizations. And the only way to really make effective change here, or to have a reasonable conversation, is to bring in a lot of difference. Voices and tools, because if it's just the science, it doesn't do much work on its own, right? This science's job is just to report on the findings of what we think is the way that we understand the world, and that's kind of where it stops.
Yeah.
And so that's where journalists or activists or politicians or leaders can pick that up and do more with it. But if we want to engage a broader audience, we've got to be really savvy about how that audience, what they want, and how they respond to that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is where, we come into things like your filmmaking, because an image, a still image in essence, is a part of a story. And, we've already said how important sound is. So combining even just a still image with sound is amazing, but to have, a motion picture with good sound and a good story that's emotive and keeps you engaged, is everything. So how do you do it?
Yeah, well, I I was saying this to you in an earlier conversation we were having on our own, but I'll repeat it here. I wonder sometimes if, well, I'll say this. The way I do my working life is I go for everything at once. My goal is to take a shotgun approach. So I'm going to try all kinds of media, all approaches to storytelling, and see what sticks. And I think part of that is that's the way I think, and that's what I'm comfortable with, and that engages me and that interests me, because for me, I feel like I can live out in a lot of different spaces. There's a lot of different ways for me to be that feel comfortable. And so it's an extension of the way that I want to be in the world. So I think sometimes when you look at my work, both the kinds of stories that I work on and the way that I tell stories, it can be all over the place. I mean, it can maybe look chaotic. To me, there's a thread that goes through all of that. And the part of the joy of doing it is constantly being challenged, constantly trying new things, constantly pushing at new spaces. I know enough about myself to know that if I didn't do that, I would just give up doing it. As soon as it becomes routine or easy, I'm out. And that's what I've done consistently in my life. So I think I've realized that I'm addicted to this. I'm addicted to the chaos. I'm addicted to the challenge. And so that's part of the reason for the answer, for why all this stuff? Why do I do filmmaking as well, among a number of other things that we're not even touching on here? But another reason why I work on film, in addition to photography and other things, is that film just has an incredible amount of power to it. I mean, there's nothing quite like the moving image, to just really bring somebody into a space and communicate ideas, because it's all art forms in one art form. And so even though I came from photography first, I really gravitated towards filmmaking because I care about these issues and I want to create work that's hopefully impactful. And so I started working on filmmaking, and I started a production company just about 10 years ago, 10 years ago now. And that production company partners with nonprofit organizations, scientists, researchers, to produce short documentary films, typically about environmental issues. But I've also worked on some other films as well. And I have to say, as a photographer moving into a filmmaking space, it's like you take all the complexity of photography, and you just turn that dial up to 1,000. It is. Filmmaking is just a monster. It's a complete bear. There's a reason why when you watch the credits on a film, there should be hundreds of people there, because it's really difficult to do these things unless you've got a really, really great team. It's a fundamentally collaborative space. But in the independent space, and particularly if you aren't able to pull down large budgets, and certainly when I started out, I wasn't. I still don't pull very large budgets. You've got to learn to do it all yourself. And so I think part of, again, to go back to the challenging part of what really pulled me in was needing to learn all these new skills about whether it's about audio production, or whether it's about motion graphics, or whether it's about designing stories the way they work for film. They work quite different for film than they do for, I mean, the elements are the same, but the way you deliver them is different for video as opposed to for photo or writing. And so it was just a real challenge, and it still is a challenge. If I decide that I need more challenge in my life, I go out and I work on a film. If I decide I want to do something just for the joy of it, I go and take pictures. So they're they play kind of a different role in my life. But just to touch on one kind of final thing here, and that's something I encourage a lot of photographers to do if they feel up for the challenge, is to really think about their work as existing in an ecosystem of media, because a lot of our tools these days that take photos can also do a lot of other things. You can make videos, even if it's with your iPhone, or it could be with your DSLR or whatever. You can make films with just a few little upgrades. You can produce podcasts, you can produce 360 video. You can produce a short series of informational videos. There's so many different things that we can create. And when you do that, when you take a story and you shop it out to all these different ways of storytelling, you do a lot of cool things. One is you reach a lot more audiences, because different audiences, engage with that media in different ways. Two, two, you get to tell the same story, but in different ways. Each one of those mediums has like a different, totally different feel to it. Maybe not totally different, but substantially different feel. So that's really compelling. And then all of those notes echo back to each other. And so you just drive more interest to your work. And it's also kind of a rarefied skill to be able to put all these things together. So I encourage, when I mentor young content creators, I really encourage them to think outside of the box and try to engage with these additional tools as much as they possibly can, if it feels comfortable. Now, if it feels like you're going to get lost in this and you're going to lose your way and it doesn't feel comfortable, then state your area that you're going to operate in that and choose that space and work in that. And that's fine too. You know, if you just want to be just a cinematographer, that's cool. If you're a podcast producer, that's cool. It doesn't mean you can't do awesome work and drive impact. You absolutely can. But just to know that if you want to expand and you want to bring in all these different ways to storytell, it's all right there. And it can be done now. Principally, you learn how to do it on the internet. You can Google it and study that on YouTube and find out most of what you need to know. You can meet people, other folks in the sector. A lot of them will be willing to talk to you about it. So it is very achievable. It might be difficult to do well. I'm not sure I've hit that bar myself yet. I'm striving, but it is very achievable to do.
No, that's cool. I mean, I like the idea that making a film is the challenge. And then I'm thinking, hang on a second, your latest film is Into the Dark?
That's right, yeah.
So is there a bigger challenge than working in the dark? Because that seems like that's not exactly what you should be doing with a camera.
Yeah, so Into the Dark. So let me just say just a little bit about this film. Using connections that I had from my degrees in climate science and work that I've done on climate reporting in the past, I found this expedition that happens not annually, but they've been going up. This team has been going up into the Arctic off and on over the past 10 years, and they're taking this trip it's about 3 weeks at sea, and what they've been trying to understand is how tiny changes in light levels are potentially changing the Arctic dramatically. And what's happening is we know that sea ice is declining, right? And over winter months, even though it's dark out, there's a tiny bit of light that's still there. So that can be light that's bouncing off the upper atmosphere. The sun's on the other side of the planet, but you get a little bit of reflection. It could be light from the moon. It's reflecting off the moon. It could be the northern lights, which gives off some light. But anyway, there's a little bit of light that's there, and typically that sea ice would be blocking it from getting into the ocean. Now with less sea ice, you have this light coming in. What does that mean for the environment? And it's totally new space scientifically. This is very, very, very novel. In fact, when this film came out, this came out in January of 2020, it came out simultaneously with a major piece being published in Nature because they had just published the results of their work, and there was a piece in Nat Geo that came out at the same time, a feature piece with them. But to get to your question, so I did a film and I did the photo article as well. But it was a huge challenge, and that was no doubt part of my reason for doing it. But not least of which, like you said, cameras paint with light, and so when you're working in a space where the sun doesn't rise, and when we were there for 3 weeks at sea, the sun did not rise. How do you take photos? You know, how do you possibly do that? And the answer was partially a technological fix. I made a contact at Sony, and I got Sony to sponsor the film by giving us equipment. And they gave us these new cameras that had come out at the time that were among the most sensitive sensors that were available. So we shot with very, very good cameras, and that helped. We had to work with artificial light quite a bit. In fact, the lead image for the project is this artificial light that's out in the middle of this kind of frozen ocean. You can go to the website and see it. MichaelOSnyder.com, by the way, is my website, and you can find that image there. But it was definitely a challenge to make compelling images in a place where there's not much light. I could go on about issues, but let me just highlight a few others. Another one is audio production. So in a film, and I've said before that, you know, God gave us eyelids, he didn't give us earlids. And if you have bad audio in a film, you went out of there so quickly. And when you're on a ship, you're on this ship, you're crunching through ice. There's these diesel engines that are whirring. I mean, it was really a very, very loud audio space to work in. And so we just fought the whole time to get clear, you know, good sounding audio. I mean, you want to create that realism, of course, for the audience, but you don't want to be lost in this, like, you know, very noisy wind ice engine sounds constantly. So it was a real challenge in terms of the audio. It was a challenge, obviously, in terms of the weather. You know, you go inside and it's warm inside, you go outside and it's well below freezing and the cameras just have fits. And then of course you're isolated. And so, you know, being able to store that much data and manage that much data when you're at sea. And finally, and infamously for me, we were in some really rough seas when we were out there, and we were at times in about 40-foot seas. And I got truly, heroically, famously, disastrously seasick for quite a long time during the making of this film. And actually, my one cameo in the film is me in the John, having a pretty rough go of it. So this is one of the adventures of my lifetime, doing this film without a doubt, and I loved it. But when that ship pulled back into port in mainland Norway, boy oh boy, I was happy to get off of it and to get onto dry land.
So you've probably learned something about your own limitations as well, do you think?
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, you know, I was gonna say, would I ever go back and shoot a film for 3 weeks at sea? But the answer should be no, but unfortunately I'm just not that wise. So I am actually already considering pushing those limitations again and potentially going back to Antarctica. To Antarctica. I've never been to Antarctica before, to do kind of an analogous film on the other side of the planet.
Mm-hmm. The other side.
So no, I don't learn my lessons very easily, unfortunately. I've got to learn them the hard way and then relearn them the hard way. But I guess that's that's just the way it is.
No, that's that's an amazing story. Right, Michael. Well, I think we're through the formal part of the interview. So what I'd like to do now is go through my fun and random questions.
Oh, okay. Great. Yes.
So are you ready?
I am as ready as I believe I'm probably going to get to be.
I chose some for your sort of area as well. So, okay, let me give you something that you'd like. Will we ever see a female James Bond?
Wow, this is a good question. Yes. Yes, I think we will see a female James Bond. I do think so. And I think that'd be kind of fascinating. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it'd have to be a different story, wouldn't it?
It would. It would be a different feel. You'd have to have a narrative reason why you would do that. Maybe they won't, but you know, I think it's exciting to see how some of those things can be challenged and, you know, open up spaces for more female characters. Does that mean that she is James Bond? I suppose not. I mean, you're right. I mean, but maybe James Bond's daughter, you know, in a certain timeline, steps into that space. But I guess what I mean to say is I think that world, the Bond world, is rich enough to have a female heroine on the level that he's on. So replace, you know, probably not, but provide more space for that kind of storyline. Yeah, I think I would guess that's coming. I'm not sure when, but it seems reasonable to assume that that's coming.
Well, there you go. There's your third project. So. Okay. Right, your next one. So you get to re-edit a line from a film. Which one of these would you choose? You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off from Italian Job. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn from Gone with the Wind. May the Force be with you from Star Wars.
Well, you can't touch perfection. So obviously number three is going that will stand. I don't.
Good answer.
So I'm not going to touch that one. You know, I'm going to go with Gone with the Wind. And I haven't seen Gone with the Wind since I was a kid, which has been some time now. So That would be the one that I would re-edit. I don't know what else you would say to Scarlett. I wonder what she deserves to hear in that space. I don't quite remember what her crimes were leading up to that that position in the film, which required her being told that dams had not been given. Did she deserve that? I don't even know. But remind me of what Scarlett had done to get that get rebuffed in such a such a way.
Okay. No, that's cool. I like that. Instead of military service, you have to take part in the Olympics. So what event would you choose and why?
Oh, wow. Well, let me say this. I was a runner in high school, and I had the very unfortunate situation that my body type is just happens to be best to run the 800 meters and the mile. And if you, that would be the last thing that anyone would ever want to choose. It's the one of the most horrific races in all of sports because you're trying to sprint the whole time for a mile and you can't. And so you just live for minutes on end in just unspeakable amounts of pain. And the whole way that you win that race is it's whoever can decide they're going to put themselves through the most possible pain. It's that's how that race gets won. And so every time I would run it, I wished to God that I had been given a body that would be suitable for a different event. So if it was a track and field event, I always wanted to be a pole vaulter. I always thought the pole vault guys were so cool. But you know what? Nowadays, they have surfing and breakdancing in the Olympics. So, man, you know, it's we're living in wow. exciting times. I'm gonna be a surfer, you know? Why not? Surfers got you get that surfer bod going. That's what I want.
Yeah,
I'd be a surfer.
I can just see the picture of you now. You're looking cool on a board. I can just see it. Yeah,
I got some work to do on my current body form. So don't you got to imagine me with a few extra muscles and a few less pounds. But you know, with those edits in mind, we can keep that picture.
Well, you know, you're good at editing, so Photoshop. That's fine, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. Exactly. That's right. Put that skill at work.
No, that's cool. Okay. When will they invent a camera for the colorblind?
Well, I think they have one. I think it's called black and white photography. That was
there we
invented
go.
In the,
You've solved
the,
it.
You know, not even this century, the previous one. So I think they already have, but I'll say this too. You've probably seen this, but there's been a lot of work done recently on colorizing old video footage. And they have AI programs now that can look at black and white. So it was shot in black and white, you know, stock film. And they can look at the black and white and interpolate what the colors would have been. And so they use AI robots to, you know, fill in the spaces. And so there's ways to do that with old black and white film. But does that mean colorblind people could? I mean, you're still looking at it, so you couldn't see it. I think the question would have to be, how do you get a colorblind person to know what a color is? And I guess that's some sort of brain, you know, interface. But you know what? There are amazing things happening in brain science, in neuroscience, and also in brain machine interface that I have to believe that conditions like colorblindness, among a whole number of other conditions, are probably solvable. There probably is a tech fix that my guess is, either in my lifetime or my children's lifetime, will be changed. So within the century, is the to answer your answer in the shortest possible way, within this century, I think colorblind people will be able to go out and take color photographs and be able to know what we can all agree on the color that's in those photographs, I think.
Michael solved it. I mean, that's another world problem, honestly.
Got a lot of plans to do. I don't know. It's getting quite full at this point.
It is, yeah, yeah. You might have to shelve a couple of the ideas there, to be honest. Okay, your last one. So this is the hardest one. You have to either give a punch, a present, or a pint to each of the following. So you got to choose one for each person. Okay. So your three people are Michael Jordan, Michael Schumacher, and the Archangel Michael.
A punt meaning like a swift kick to the backside? Is that what you mean by a punt?
Yeah, so you got a pint as in a drink, a beer.
I got that
a
one.
A punch. Yeah. Or a present.
Got it. Okay. Michael Jordan. Oh my gosh. Well, I am a child. I was born in 1981, and so Michael Jordan was just the coolest dude right there with Michael Jackson when I was a kid. So I probably wouldn't know what to do if I saw him. I definitely would not try to punt him. I would buy Michael Jordan a pint. I mean, he's just one of the greatest athletes of all time. I would think pint. He gets pint. Michael Schumacher, let's see, okay. And this is where we're going to see the edges of my knowledge of things. He's the race car driver, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Is he a nice fella?
Well, that's a good point, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm asking an earnest question. I'm not quite sure what he gets, so I'm trying to do a little bit of detective work here. Is there something I don't know about Michael Schumacher that I should know?
He's not a very well man at the minute, but
he gets a present then.
Yeah.
If he's poorly, it's okay. A present. Yeah, present.
Very, very, very
present
poorly,
then, yes. For sure. And a hug. Yeah. Okay. He's got that one. Okay. And what was our last one? And the Archangel Michael.
So that means you're going to punch
no
the Archangel.
Oh wait, they each have to get one. I see I can only give one to each, so I couldn't give a pint for all of them. Oh gosh, I've got to get in a fight with the voice of God. Not the voice of God, that's Gabriel. What is Michael? Again, he's the he who walks with God, Mikhail. Oh my gosh, so I've got to take down the second in command, huh? Boy, that's a tall order. But you know what? I can't away the present from Schumacher, and I'm not going to punch Michael Jordan. So it's got to be punches for the Archangel. Not a very good Christian.
You heard it here, everybody. Yeah,
I've just been excommunicated from some church somewhere, I'm sure.
Thank you so much for going through that, Michael. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you so much for those.
Oh, no problem. I always like to end on a bit of a happy note and have a bit of fun. I think it's good in life to do things like that.
I agree with that. It's a good way to approach it.
Thank you. So the last thing I always ask my guests, I do this pay it forward scheme. So is there anyone that you would recommend work I should check out, whether it's from photography, cinematography, totally different genres, that's doing really good work that you think I should look at?
Yeah. Well, there's just so many people. Rather than one name, although I can pick out some for you, but I was just looking at some networks of people and that may not be on your radar. So one I would definitely check out is called the Blue Earth Alliance. And I'm a member of the Blue Earth Alliance. Okay. And it's a collective of photographers and filmmakers that are all working on environmental issues. And there are just too many amazingly talented and really wonderful people in there to pick out. And if you don't find what you're looking for there, the other organization that's also, it's got just a great collective of very similar people is called ILCP, and that's the International League of Conservation Photographers. And they, it's a very similar league, but there's just tons of really, really talented, really, really wonderful people in there. And I know that a lot of the people in these organizations, their goals are to share their work because they're passionate not only about photography, but about the issues and the people and the species and the places that they work with, and so oftentimes want to get their stories out there. So you'll find some wonderful people, and this is for the audience too. If you're interested in environmental photography or issues based work, then those are great resources to take a look at.
No, that sounds wonderful. Yeah, well, I mean, trying my best to give people a place to talk about their passions and. Yeah, recently it's been artists giving them space because, let's face it, this year there hasn't been any space for them. So I think science is probably a really good aspect for me to focus a bit of time on, to be honest.
Yeah, and these are all people that are sort of bridging that space between science and art and journalism and activism and probably wearing a lot of those hats. And I think that's a trend we've seen a lot recently, is that there are very few people that are purely one thing and nothing else. We're seeing people engaging a lot of different kinds of spaces, and that's exciting. But I want to thank you. I think this is a really cool opportunity to be able to come on and share, and a really great thing that you're doing, providing a platform for people to both to share what they're up to, and hopefully for quite a few people to get engaged and be able to listen in and find something that interests them as well. So thank you so much for having me on and for taking the time.
Oh, thanks, Mike. And that's really appreciated. I wish you all the success. I know it'll keep coming. There's been some beautiful projects. I know you've always got ideas as well. So don't go on too many boat trips, though.
Don't worry. I am landlocked for quite some time to come.
And I look forward you to achieving some of the goals we've set for you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I will update you along the way.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much, Michael.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks a lot, mate. And you take care.
Yeah, you take care too. This was fun.
Hey, I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed interviewing. Please don't forget, if you want to get involved, I'm starting to put out there on social media the list of guests for that week. You are welcome to submit any questions you want to ask, and hopefully I'll read them out for you. Whether you want to do that through Instagram, direct message, you can just click, if you click on the direct message bit, there's a button there and you can record and send that right across. But there's many apps you can do, or email me, or send me a DM on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. That's cool with me. For those of you who want to support the show, please don't forget, iTunes reviews are always appreciated, and obviously I will read them out the following week for you, and I tend to use them on social media, so that's all very much appreciated. If you'd like to help contribute towards the show, then don't forget there's my Ko-fi page, where you can submit anything from $1, pounds or upwards, and I'll keep a note on there what I'm trying to achieve as the months and years go by. For those who want to keep coming back to the show, don't forget you can just subscribe in your friendly podcast app of choice, and there's a weekly newsletter on my website, flogger.co.uk, so that's PHLOGGER, and you'll get an automated email from me, and that tells you each week what's gone up on the website. So it's the podcasts and any articles I've wrote. So yeah, thank you so much, and I'll see you again soon. Bye.